It's 15 past, so I guess we can begin. Like before, log in to these web pages or slides. You can probably see the slide URL there, or just click on the course main page to get there. And like before, I would like you to make groups of at least three people, three or four members in each group. Since this lecture is divided so that you will spend approximately 52 minutes, if my schedule holds, talking with your friends, and I will be talking for about 30 minutes during the class, it makes really little sense to be sitting alone right now because you are not getting anything out of the lecture. So please, everyone, find at least three friends or two friends if you can't manage three. And if you don't know anyone, just you are sitting in middle of the row, you don't have any friends, pick a friend from your right-hand side. Everyone is friendly and probably no one will bite. Okay. So, first bit of this administrative stuff. Like before, I'm going to keep this lecture in broken English since we have English-speaking persons in our audience. And first order of business is again this anonymous query. If you have any trouble, don't click on the bell. That's for me to click when necessary. Okay. This anonymous feedback form, if you have some worries or some troubles or I'm unpolite towards you or I fail your exercise without any reason or any such complaint, just place it there. Antti Juhani, who is very just fellow, will read them through and then punish me if I do something wrong. So he's your immediate go-to person if I'm mistreating you in any way, which is, of course, not my intention. So here's the link for the feedback form. Any troubles, go there. Okay. And then, first query. In last lecture, I gave you five tips of how you can ensure that you pass this course. So let's just spend a few seconds and please answer this query. I mean, how well are you doing currently? And I'm not using this to judge you in any way or give you grades or anything like this. I just want to know what of these things you are doing. And the English translation, first item, check this if you have read through the course materials for this lecture. That is, you go to the course main page, find this lecture, you have gone through everything before that lecture. Second one, do you have a Haskell book? Have you read a little bit, found some book to aid you in your studies? Third one is my controversial. Did you do at least 30 minutes of Haskell or functional programming every day last week? Fourth one, do you use this Slack channel? Do you ask questions using that Slack channel and do you check for course announcements there? And final question, are you feeling desperate right now? Okay, everyone click in your answers and we see the general lay of the land. Okay, done. Anyone have trouble logging in right now? No? Yeah, almost everyone has read the course material. You know, kudos, that's nice. That's exactly what you should be doing. Haskell book. Most of you haven't gotten a Haskell book. You really should, because my course material, it's very sparse, it's short, it doesn't elaborate enough. So Learn Your Haskell is a book, it's free, you can just go and download it if you want. And other books are even nicer, so just spend a few minutes and do this for the next week. I mean, this will help you really much. 30 minutes a day, well, you know, I'm surprised that this many people actually managed to do this. You know, congratulations, you are very well on your route to passing this course. And why 30 minutes every day? Well, if you only work on weekends, you probably will forget too much stuff between the iterations. Using Slack, nice participation, good. For those 12 people who don't, please do, because all the course announcements will be on Slack. Suppose I have to cancel a lecture. It will be on Slack and nowhere else. So if you don't look there, you will come and you have boring 2 hours in an empty classroom. So that's kind of a mandatory thing. And feeling desperate, well, nice. Most of you are not feeling desperate. To those who are feeling desperate, don't worry. Just come to the supervised sessions and tell Antti, Juhani or Samsa or me that you are feeling desperate and we'll help you on your way. You are actually kind of supposed to feel at least small despair at this point. If the course curriculum is going well, you are at this point 10% worse programmers than before starting this course. So small amount of desperation is, you know, appropriate. Okay, but in general, you are, based on this poll at least, doing better than I thought. Thumbs up. Then another administrative thing. This is basically only for, yes, question. Yeah. Question, how do you find important stuff or stuff said by me in Slack? Well, I can't open Slack right now, but you can first search with my username, Tironen. It will show you all the things that I have said. And then there is this sidebar and option pinned items. Pinned items are things that you can find on the sidebar, and they are usually those big announcements that are currently in, currently you should heed to. So try to find those. Okay, then final administrative fact before continuing, and this is only for remote students. So if you are watching this through the camera, next time do not email me your lecture questions, because, you know, I got so many that I will probably lose few. Instead, I have added few upload boxes to the course web pages, so you can upload these course questions there. Okay. And one additional thing. I have, over the years, made a few, you know, 20 or so small Haskell programming examples of various topics during my courses. So I made a library about these video examples. You can find all kinds of live coding examples and stuff there. Some of it might be out of date, but some is current. And why do we have these small videos in this course? Because during the lectures, we don't have quite a lot of time to, for me to code live or demonstrate how the Haskell tools work. So, you know, those parts are on the video and you can watch them if you need. Okay, any questions about this? Some of the, and all of the videos are of course horrible because I have zero production values. I do not edit, I do not cut the videos, I do not even insert any kind of headers or anything. So just one clip and it goes straight into the internet. Yeah, okay. Agenda for today. I'm going to do a short live coding demonstration, very small Haskell program. I don't have time for large programs. Just to, you know, ensure that everyone has seen how to make a Haskell program, basically. Then we are going to talk a little bit about variables, something about function literals and functions as values, and finally we are going to try to understand how function types work. So this is what we try to do. And we probably are going to skip few lecture questions again in order to fit this all in, you know, this 90-minute slot. So I will take general questions after the lecture, so I think we can proceed with this agenda, right? Okay. First, this live coding example. I tried to pick a program that is very small and something that most of you actually know. And this is the so-called rainfall problem, which Vesa has been using in his programming courses for, I think, 3 years or so. It's usually one of the exam questions. And it's a really simple program. It goes like this. You are given a list or set or vector of numbers, depending on language you are working with. You have to compute the average of these numbers with two conditions. You don't add any negative numbers in the average, so you discard all negative numbers. And when you encounter the number 999, you stop computing. That ends your input. So this is, you know, rather elementary program, I don't know, might come up in some actual programming task. But it's a small and nice example. And I dug up the really original version of this program, the article where this program was used to test how students write code from, I think, early 80s. And it looks like this. The picture is slightly small, but hopefully you can see it on your own screen. This is a Pascal implementation of this Haskell program. And it's just one big while loop, some initializations and one big while loop. And, you know, of course, if your program is this short, it really doesn't matter which language you use. Everything is just good enough because it's so small, you always re-implement that. It's not a big problem. You can write this in assembler and it's still okay. It's so short program. But if you are going to use this as an example, there are, you know, plenty of flaws in this program. This is early programming. Programming has really changed in the last 40 years or so. And if you look at this from the viewpoint of a Haskell programmer, there are a few things that are instantly annoying. For example, it's one big loop. So if you have this program, you write this, you get nothing out of it except that program. You can't get any reusable parts. You can't reuse any functions to build up this program. It's just one big chunk. And it won't compose. You have this chunk, you can't, you know, put it in a larger program. It won't fit. Why it doesn't fit? There's, you know, input and output inside this program. You know, there's outputting some strings, querying the user, doing things like this. So if you would like to include this in your own program, yeah, you would get these default, you know, interactions also. And yeah, it also, you know, merges this logic, like, you know, interleaves it. So you interleave the input and output reading of the numbers. You interleave the testing, the termination, and then the actual computations. They're all, you know, mixed up together. And this is one of the reasons why this program won't compose. And, you know, programming in today's world is all about making composable parts. We can't build a million line programs without making smaller programs inside that build up this huge pyramid of software. So, using Pascal, it looks a bit like this, a very simple program. Now, a short demonstration of how we can actually do this in Haskell. What I did already is I set up a new stack project. It takes so long time that I did it before. So this is the command how you get it. And what does this net me? It gives me a few files, this capable file, setup, stack, YAML, everything that describe how a simple Haskell program is being built. For this course, this is, you know, over the top. This is too complex. But if you make a real program, you are interested in all these facts. What are the program's dependencies and how to build it and so on. So let's start it like this. So we open up GHCI. This is our main tool usually when we are making Haskell programs. And it has this nice edit command which pops up an editor that I can use. This probably won't work in Windows, and it's anyway better to open the editor in the separate window. This is two model. But okay, how do we start writing a Haskell program? Well, the important part is, of course, like in all programming, make a few examples of how your program should work. Without these examples, you can't really, you know, or with this simple program, you probably can simulate it in your head. But in general, it's a very good practice. So this is one of our, you know, potential inputs. Oops. Add a comma there. And what should we get from this? Well, first, well, let's make it a bit more complex. So like this. Firstly, we are going to discard these two numbers because the 1000 minus 1 terminates the input. Well, I don't know why, but it does. Then we are going to discard this minus 3 because it's negative and compute the average between 1 and 2. So we get 1.5. always, when we are working with Haskell code that eats lists, we always need to check what happens when you are given an empty list. And in this case, if you are averaging an empty list of numbers, we can't get a really good result. There's nothing to average. If you are naive with this, you get division by zero. So we usually would use maybe in this. This is a partial function. In this case, we would say nothing. And then we would say just here. But to make this short and simple, let's just crash our program there. It's unimportant to the point like what I'm making. Don't do this in your coursework because that's really stupid. Don't do this in your production programs because that's really stupid. So, okay, here's my examples. Usually, I would probably write something like 5 or so examples. So, how do we make this program work? Let's call it rainfall. Special case, the empty list first, so we don't have to worry about that. So, empty list is an error. Well, then we have a non-empty list. So, at this point, a Java programmer or C-sharp programmer, a Java programmer would probably reach for for loop. C-sharp programmer would probably reach for, what is it called, this SQL-like thing inside C-sharp, this, I forgot the name, what is it called, this?
Link.
Link, yeah. C-sharp programmers would reach for link. Link is actually quite close to what I'm making now. So, how do I write this? It's going to return a result. So, let's make this program from top down. This gives me an opportunity to demonstrate this where keyword. So I get a result. And in the where block, I can make variable bindings. A result, it's average of the numbers. Okay, what are the numbers? It's the set of numbers where I remove all the negative numbers. We can, for example, do that first. And I have to have something that is taking the list up to the number 999. So, I have, this is my strategy. I make a word, I have this kind of variable, then make the immediate next computation that I need, and invent new variables when I need. For example, I invented this the numbers variable. I decided that I need a variable that contains something, and then I just expand on my ideas. So the numbers, it's a list where I take all of these, negative numbers away, and I have already taken the 999 out of the list. Yes?
It's just puzzling to me that when you say a result equals average the numbers, doesn't it like say you haven't declared the numbers yet?
Yeah, because this is how I construct the program. The numbers, it's at least. Could I switch the lines? Yeah, I could. Yeah, the order of the definitions doesn't matter. You can just
try to find out if Haskell actually is smart enough to
For most part, Haskell allows you to write definitions in any order. So you can introduce a function here and call it here. Doesn't make any difference. There are a few rules, like you can't add stuff between the type declaration and the function declaration. And stuff like case statements, you have to order your patterns from most specific to most loose, so you don't capture things accidentally. Okay, next up, I have this up to, and I have to figure out how to compute this. Well, Luckily, Haskell has a very large standard library, contains this function take while, and take until you encounter 999. And this works for the original list. So, yeah, here's the rainfall program. First version might have compilation errors. I should run something like GHID on the side here to see the errors right now. But I guess this is so small program, it's safe for me to try this. So, let's see. Not in scope. Average. I have no function called average. So, well, I guess I have to define average function. And for purposes of this lecture, I'm going to do this really badly. So, this is not going to be, you know, the way you should do things. And, well, what is the definition of average? It's number of elements and divided by length of elements. Of course, this yet doesn't work. I have this problem that length returns an integer number, and you can't divide by an integer in Haskell. It doesn't do this implicit conversion to doubles when necessary. So I have to explicitly tell it to convert this integer number into double. And why is this so bad? Well, obviously, if I have a huge list, you know, doing sum first, I have to go through all the elements of the list. Then I have to keep the list in memory, and the length goes through all the elements in the list. So it's going to do a lot of extra work. But this is the first credit of the course, so no problem. Let's do extra work. Yeah, now it seems to work. And rainfall, empty list, yeah, that is the error I placed there. 1, 2, 3 seems to work. 999 seems to work. Adding negative numbers seems to work. So, your very short and speed Haskell program demonstration. Important points. Usually when we make programs in Haskell, we compose the functionality of the smaller pieces. Just compose different functions, like average, filter, take while, sum. All of these are individual parts that you can use in every program you write. So this is, in general, better than the Pascal example. We have reusable parts. Then what is nice, we have separated the program entirely from input and output. So next step would be, I might make a video out of this later when we talk about I/O, would to make this ask the numbers from user behavior. You could implement that separately. And then finally, there is this top-down approach to making programs. You start with the thing you want, then you specify what kind of a thing it is that you want, average of something. Then you specify what is that something that you are averaging, and what are inputs for that, and any auxiliary functions that you need, you just put them there. So it's a very principled approach to writing programs. Okay. Bit of a letdown of a program. It's too simple to be exciting, but here it is. Any questions about this? Okay, now you've seen at least one Haskell program. And we can continue. It's also, it's about half the size of this. It will be about the same size when we add the input and output. Then if we just reduce all of these nested definitions using the dot operator or whatever, we get the shorter version again. So that's live coding. Probably everyone agrees that I just should make videos out of these and you can watch them whenever you like, right? Okay. Let's go to the first actual topic that we have, which is variables and binding. This is the thing that really separates Haskell from Java or C Sharp. Variables are not the same variables as in Java or Python or whichever language. In ordinary imperative languages or object-oriented languages, a variable, it's kind of a, like a reference to a box that contains some value, at some point of the time, and you know, keep executing your program, and perhaps some other value will enter that box. For example, you have variable called x, and in start of your program, x contains value 11. You execute few statements more, and the x contains value 1,000. It's the same variable, but the value inside changes. And this is what enables you to do stuff like loops. For example, while loop, you have to change some kind of variable to point to different parts of an array, for example. In Haskell, we do not have this. Not at all. We can't change variables. Variables are not boxes with values that depend on time. In Haskell, variables are just indicators of certain parts of your expression. This variable n, this argument n here, it only indicates that this thing here refers to this place and this place and this place of this equation. So it doesn't make sense to think that I add some value or change the value inside n. N is just the place in the equation where you replace stuff when you need to. Antti-Juhani is about to protest, but this is a simplification. And you can't really at all think about, you know, modifying a value. Instead, you write your programs a bit like inside out. If you have to modify a value, instead of putting that next step on the next line, you modify, make it a function, pass the new value into the function, and work like this. So instead of modifying variables, we bind variables. That is, you know, what, for example, this let statement is doing. You read this as, you know, this statement binds x to the value of 5 in the expression x times 14 plus x. So how is this computed? What happens when I compute this? Well, on the simplest possible level, it just is going to replace all x's with number 5. So what it does, it doesn't assign value or doesn't put value in some mysterious box. It just writes it in the equation at the places indicated. That's all. That's how variables work. Okay, bigger example. So if we call this function, say fib5, for example, it works like this. It's going to bind the parameter n to the value of 5 in this expression. Meaning, in layman's terms, it's going to go into the expression, find all n's there, and replace them with number 5. So, intermediate step, function call with an argument, it's a let statement. It basically, fib5 says, let n be 5 in this body of the function. And like before, we then go and find all the occurrences of the variable and replace them with number 5. It's very simple. There's really nothing to it. It's just like search and replace. Only problem is that if you end up in a situation where you have multiple variables with the same name, that's the difficult part. But even that is very simple to think about. Yeah. So, to reiterate once more, it's just a place in the expression. And first, lecture question that I have you to think is that if I actually do use the same variable name in my program for several times, what does it mean? If I have this program, what is this x? Are these the same variable, x2 and x, are these the same? Or are these the same? Which variable does this point to? Both? One? Okay. And to make sure everyone has enough time, I have a new feature in my slides. I have this timer that you can use to think. It gives you 220 seconds to think by yourself. And if this is too much, you know, you get bored, then just shout and I will skip this part. I can't stop the timer though, because I wasn't smart enough to anticipate need for that. So. Yeah, and this timer feature is because last lecture someone complained that I go too fast, so I have an absolute reference of time, how fast I'm going. Somehow this silence is, you know, like someone died. But, you know, if this is too long time, we change it for the next time. Just to estimate how long time we actually need. Hands up if you actually completed the assignment yet already. So everyone, and we are just, you know, waiting 2 minutes more. Well, hey, let's make this a beneficial exercise for you. If you answered this question already, close your eyes and just focus on your breathing for, you know, 100 seconds. This is extremely invigorating and probably, you know, refreshes you enough to manage through the end of the lecture. So 100 seconds silence, close your eyes and breathe. And I guess this will end up in this Antti-Juhani's complaint form, but let's do it anyway. Also makes very nice lecture video for the remote students. Oh. Okay, this is just way excessive. Sorry about that. Yeah, I thought a small sound would be nice, but this is probably... Oh, see. Okay, yeah, right. The speakers, right, big speakers. Yes. Okay, sorry about this. So, you know... It seems that a clear consensus is that most people think that it's going to be this X2. The consensus is actually so big that I don't think we... Do we need a group discussion about this? Hands up if you think it's going to be beneficial. Okay, so any one of you who clicked this bar, why is this X referring here? What is the rule? Why that one? Yeah. I probably didn't understand exactly, but okay, let's give the rule and ask again if I just really missed your question. Why does this X refer to this one here? The rule is that variable bindings refer to the innermost introduction of that variable. So we say that this X shadows all of the other references. So we read through, start from here, check what is the expression structure. This is a plus plus expression, you could parenthesis around here. It's inside this definition, and in this definition we bind X. And this definition is inside this module in where we bind X here. So we choose the innermost thing. This x in this expression, which is in this definition, which binds the x. Okay, this is the first occurrence outside or in this expanding scope that actually defines what x is. And what is it? It's a parameter for the greeting function. So it's something that, you know, something that we get when the function is called, but not before. Okay, is this clear enough? One person in middle of the classroom is nodding, so it's clear enough. Okay, next question, and I'm not going to make this 220-second self-think part because that's too much. But okay, what's happening here? If I write something like this, I make multiple definitions like this. What does this mean in Haskell? Does it compute like this? Is it a compile time error? It's going to say that I'm redefining the same thing multiple times. Or is it going to be a runtime error? It's going to be, you know, infinite recursion, infinite loop. So what's going to happen? You know, let's be moderate. Let's take something like, I think, you know, 1 minute to think. That's probably plenty for this. That's your 1 minute, so click in your personal answer. And the current tally is 1 minute, as most of the answers here. So how many did actually try this in GHI right now? Okay, cool. So I think we have enough, you know, variance in here. So let's actually make a discuss with your friends about this. You know, you answered something. Convince your friends that you were actually correct. And now you are going to get the horrible sound effects again.
Sillä kongilla saa ihmiset hiljaiseksi arvoteleeksi.
Whoa.
ticking sound mean clicking your answers? I'm really going to remove this bong after that. Anyways, let's click if someone didn't manage. Okay, so I think you got it absolutely correctly, for very large majority at least. So it doesn't compute 1 plus 2 plus 3. I mean, it's Haskell. It's not going to change the value of s. There's no reason for it to compute 1 plus 3. It's like, you know, why would it discard the middle definition theory? Wouldn't make sense in any language, really. And, well, most of you think it's a compile error. You are redefining giving multiple definitions for single one thing. And there is a small minority that thinks it's a runtime error. It's, endless recursion. Okay, this last one, it's something sensible. You are quite close with the last one. Because in Haskell, if you write something like this, the let statement is a recursive. So if you have this kind of a definition here, it can be a recursive definition. It can refer to the its own name. So this s here, using the rule innermost scope defines the variable, this s is the same as this s here. So it could be infinite recursion. And the only reason why it's not an infinite recursion is because Haskell is smart enough to detect this, and it interferes with other features of the language. So if we have something like, let's make a silly sum function again. Something like this. Because we can make these binding groups in Haskell. So we can give these piecewise definitions for our functions. So it interferes with this thing. So usually we apply it so that we make these multiple definitions with different patterns. And now, of course, this won't work if you have nothing to, tell these S apart, the same S. It's just two definitions for the exact same thing. And this is going to cause this multiple declarations error. But frankly, if this was an exam, either of these two answers would have been correct enough. Okay, any questions about this? Yeah. Don't try to make sequence or variable updates in Haskell. It won't work until the next course, at least. So next topic, function literals. And these are the things that you get if you're programming Python, for example, or Ruby has something that's almost like this. Java has something that is unwieldy and like this. So first thing before we get to function literals is about how you use functions in Haskell. So if we have a statement like mapsort.words, where the dot is defined like this, dot is a elementary combinator. It takes two functions and sequences them inside one another. So means that this is a function that first calls x and feeds the answer to f and returns what f returns. So the question is this a valid Haskell expression? Is this something that you can compute with? And, it's not a valid Haskell expression for some reason x. You can compute it, and it will result in a value that is actually a function. Or final option, you can compute this, or you can't actually compute this, but if you add one argument here, you could compute it. Because this is going to be some kind of a function, and to compute with functions you need a string. Something like this. So around a minute of thinking by yourself, is this a sensible Haskell expression or not? I'm going to check when this number changes into 2, and that's my minute. yeah, that's your 1 minute. So, let's wait until, yeah, now it seems to be converging. Everyone got their answer, it seems. So, yeah, majority of you think that you can compute with this, and the result is a function. There's, I think, 8 people around who don't know why this is. Or if it is like this. I think we skip the group part for this. It's too large majority that is already correct. So yeah, of course we can compute with this. The result is a function. It's obvious. We take two functions, we apply and operate them, we get another function. We could then say put this function in a list of results or save it somewhere or call it if we want. So the first one is obviously false. Second one is correct. Third one is actually not correct. Because third one is this misconception that I see very often in these courses, which means that you can't have function that is just there by itself. In Java, you have to call all your functions. If you write a function name, you have to call it or it's a compile error. In Haskell, functions can, you know, they survive very well alone. So you can compute. And what do you get? Well, you get a function. F is this map sort. G is the words. You get something like this. This is your function. We are, even in Haskell, we have this way of writing it down. So we have function literal. And that is the exact result of this function. So any questions remaining about this? Yeah, you got this very nicely correct. So we won't worry about that. So what is this, you know, slash x? We usually call these lambda statements or lambda literals. It just means that a function that takes an x as an argument and computes this. And we can, of course, if we give a name for this, it would be equivalent to writing the definition like this. So we can make a definition of the function, or if we don't need to make a definition for the function, we can just use this anonymous function or anonymous literal for a function. And it's very useful because many functions in Haskell say map. Map is a function that applies the first argument to all elements of the second argument. So for example, here we have function that extracts the name and address of some employee data type. And you know, in Haskell we have so many of these small functions, it doesn't make really sense to name them all. So it's used, you know, quite often. And yeah, since it's used quite often, and since Haskell has this very fluid syntax, we have this problem of how do we read these expressions? How do we actually, you know, make sense out of these? Because these can be nested inside one another. Makes life hard for the first few weeks. So 1 minute according to this number here. How do you actually parenthesize thing like this? Don't, you know, mind about what thing actually does. I can demonstrate that later. Just a, you know, expression, some weird operators, something like this. How do you read it? How do you parenthesize? What are the important parts of this? Okay, that was a really short minute. Can you answer all already? This is a hard question, so I, you know, going to spend, you know, something like 20 seconds more, so everyone can get some kind of idea. This actually is quite important fact. If you get this wrong, there's few exercises that you will also get wrong systematically. And when you go to the more advanced Haskell features, this is going to bite you if you get this wrong. So let's spend time on getting this right. Okay, everyone has some opinion fed in. And Yeah. The first one leads for a small number. I think, you know, you used to have more answers. Yeah, seems to have converged at this point. So, first one is in the lead, but it still could be either of the below ones. So let's make a small group discussion. And remember, just convince your friends that you are correct. And just a hint for you, you don't know what this part is. You have never seen this. It's just an Haskell operator. There's no new syntax in this part. It's just like the plus or the division. It's just an operator. Yeah, it seems it didn't really actually help. You are not easily convinced by your friends. Okay, I think it's my turn to try to explain this. So, first something simpler. If I have, you probably tried something like this in the exercises. If I have something like this, can I put the parenthesis around here? Well, of course I can put the parenthesis around here, but the meaning is completely different. So when you are parenthesizing these lambda expressions, the parentheses are over this entire thing. So if you want to terminate this lambda expression, you have to actually put another set of parentheses around it. So that's the first point, meaning that, you know, can't really be this one, because there's no parentheses, for example, around this part to, you know, split this subsection out of it. So it can't be this one. The next part is to note that, of course, this thing here, that's just a Haskell operator, so it could be written in place here. That wouldn't make a difference what operator is. So next question after that, can I nest lambda expressions? Can I put one lambda expression inside another? Meaning that, can I do this, that this lambda y to y per 2, can I put it inside the body of this outer lambda function? That's the question, all right? And yes, turns out that I can. So it doesn't matter if I have what my expressions here are. Lambda function, lambda literal is an expression, just like any other expression. So I can put this thing here. It's going to work. Probably want to put parentheses around it to make myself clear. Okay, a bit about this exercise. It's intentionally a bit abstract. I chose a symbol that you don't know the meaning for. And this is intentional. It's not a programming example. It's an example that you have to figure out the rules. And that's actually easier to do when you don't know these distracting details of how this star is going to work. Anyways, was that complete nonsense? If I write is this something that Haskell will appreciate? Yeah, it actually is. And this is something that you will learn probably at the beginning of the next functional programming course, whenever we get the time to make that happen. It's a function that takes another function as an argument and then some value. And we can let's put plus in there and number 5, and we get a nice result, 7.5. So just as a teaser, come to the next course and this will be immediately obvious why this thing happens. So what it does is I have a function of 2 parameters. I give one value, that's the another parameter, and this one will be the other. Sampsa's code is full of these, and his master of crunching his code into very small cryptic pieces. But anyways, it's a sensible Haskell expression. Important points, this is how you use lambda functions. Okay, partial application. Another thing that is easy to use, easy to explain when we have this function application in our tool palette. So you have probably figured out that you can call Haskell functions with only subset of the arguments. So if you have 2-parameter function, you can call it with only 1 parameter. And you get a nice, reasonable result. So if you leave some parameters out, say you call whatever function of 2 parameters with 1, you get a function that fixes the first parameter and still expects the second. And it's easy to think with the function literals. For example, map is a function. Map sort argument would apply function sort to each element of the argument. So if I leave the 3rd parameter out, what do I get? And the computation is pretty much like this. I have this rule of, you know, introducing abstractions. So if I have a function like this, I can always wrap a lambda around. If this is a function, I can always do this. So if I leave one argument out, I get a lambda function that, you know, adds the missing argument. So obvious, the result is a function that takes the remaining argument, the one that we did not give. Okay, clear? Well, if it's not clear, ask me in the supervised sessions or next lecture. I will explain it again. But it's nice to be able to write functions as a, you know, literals. Yeah. That's about all that I could think of about function literals. Important part, how to read it, you can nest it. You have to put parentheses around it if you want to split it apart. Then, function types. This is a stumbling block. You know, in every course, we have troubles with this concept. And this is actually one of the nicest things in Haskell. So it's worth learning. You have already noticed in the course material and when you play with Haskell that if you type a function in GHI, let's ask for type, you can write T. And for example, function sign, that's from school. Everyone knows what sin does or done. And you get a function that in essence looks something like this. Some type, arrow, some other type. Probably we have some constraints like here, or the function words that we used earlier. A type, arrow, another type. So that's how you write functions in Haskell. And this is importantly on the same level of concepts as, for example, pairs. If you have pair of A and B, list of A's, function types are exactly in the same region. They are types. You can write function type in every place where you can write any arbitrary type. And you can use functions as arguments and so on. So they are not really different from lists or any other thing. Only difference is that you can't extract values from functions with any other means than calling them or giving them arguments. And the translation is, this is a function. Give me an A and I will give you a B. That's the meaning of this statement. So, function type is a type, meaning that I can, you know, use it to construct bigger types. I have function from int to int. I have a pair containing functions from int to int. That's valid. I have a function that takes as an argument a function from int to int and produces a function from int to int. Or I can have a function from int that gives me functions from int to int. This is actually a two-parameter function in Haskell. You first give this first int, then you get a function. You call it again with the second int, and you get the real result. Any ideas? Antti-Johan is going to hate me for this. Antti-Johan, give me an example of a function that has this type. Function from int to int. You are the icebreaker now. Yeah, function that, you know, multiplies pi minus 1. That's a nice function from int to int. So, this thing, the pair thing, what kind of value, what thing would have type like this? Anyone? Doesn't have to be a very sensible value. You don't have to figure out how to use it, but anything that would look like this. Any ideas? Yes. So, translated a pair of functions. For example, we could use Antti-Johan's function negate, which flips the sign. And then another function would be function take absolute values. So, yeah, we have negation, absolute values. That's a pair of functions. Okay, third one. That's difficult. Anything come to mind? Okay, if you can't figure out any, this is a bit abstract. It doesn't really matter. It's a function that I give another function as an argument. So, well, I could call it, let's say that's called f. I could, for example, call it like this. This is how I would call that. And then I would get, as a result, another function that does something. Well, it could be any number of things. Something like a function, it returns a function that takes another number, adds x, and calls the function g with the other number. Anyway, play with things like this on GHI, because these are really different from what you are used to, and also quite hard to figure out on the fly during the lecture. And try to make, you know, several of these, write them down, see how they behave, and get the intuition of how things work in Haskell. Third one, it's just a two-parameter function, takes 2 ints. It could be plus, for example. Okay, now, 30 seconds or 60 seconds for this problem. In Haskell, like I just said, multi-parameter functions, they have multiple arrows. So you read this. This is a function that takes an int and a string and produces a string. Since this arrow, it's operator, it's an operator in the type expressions, but operator nonetheless. The first thing to ask is that is this, you know, can I put parentheses there? Is this an operator like plus and other things? Does it have an associativity? Is it? And if it does have an associativity, do the parentheses go on which side of the function? One important thing, of course, because we have many of these functions and function types. The rest of the course is pretty much about, you know, it's going to be type errors all over again, and you really have to be able to read things like this and to make the types friends instead of enemies. Okay, all done. Yeah, I hear clicks, so things are getting done, but not yet done. Okay, now I don't hear clicks anymore, so it's probably all done. So, it seems that there is a point to discuss here. Most people think that it's the latter one, but there's still a large minority that disagrees. So, at this point, you might want to do this thing that when you are working in a group and arguing, if everyone in your group agrees, everyone thinks that it's like this, you know, turn around, find some other group and find out someone who disagrees with you and, you know, convince him. If everyone in the same group agrees, then it's boring otherwise. Thank you. You know the answer. It's, I think, almost obvious to almost everyone. For those seven of you who are either disagreeing or, you know, not convinced, how does this thing work? So this function arrow here, it means that, how do we read this? Give me this part and I will give you this part. So there's just one thing here. This is a function that you give another function as an argument and you receive a string as a result. This, however, give me this part, give me an int, and I will give you a function that takes a string and outputs a string. So this is equivalent to this. I first give it an int, say 5. It gives me a function that takes a string and returns a string, and I give it a string, say cat, and I get a string. This, however, to call this function, I have to give it a function as an argument. I have to give it something like something that turns an int into a string. Probably not very sensible function. Okay, cool. This one you got correctly, and I guess this does something, you know. Quite many people, 17 people disagreed, and now only 7 people disagree. So learning is actually taking place if you are doubtful if this question thing is actually doing anything. Okay. Now, more difficult question. This is actually a hard question, or harder, hardish, medium hard, perhaps. So if I have x arrow y, I read function from x's to y's. Then I have this kind of definition. F x y equals if x then y else 2 times y. Another senseless expression. Which of these declarations would be correct? F has the type of int. F has the type of bool to int, a function from bools to ints. F has the type of function from bools to ints, or, you know, like this. 1 minute of thinking by yourself. Also think about good arguments to convince your friends with. And I again, you know, wait until this number changes. Okay, that's probably 40 seconds or so. Click in the answers. Click, 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 and so on. And since you are tapping at the radiator, which makes me think that people are constantly clicking, not going to progress. Okay, I guess everyone has clicked in their answers. And yeah, worried that my widget doesn't work. So we have two strong candidates. This and this, and well, you know, not this, because we just agreed that this thing doesn't work like this. And yeah, obviously it's a function, not an int. And you know, it could be a function from bools to ints. Why isn't it though? Why is this thing wrong? And I know that there's 38 people here in the classroom who think that this is not so, but why? Any of you 38 care to fill us in? Yes? Yeah, it requires two parameters. There's x and y. If I would write a function like this, there would be only x or y there. And of these two, yeah, they are correct. You know, it's two arguments. X, that's a boolean. It's boolean because it's inside this if. You can only write booleans there. Y is an int. Well, in this good as any. It's a number, you can multiply it by 2. And similarly like this, like I said, you can put parentheses around this latter part. The arrow operator associates to the right. No, I don't think there's any call for discussion here. This is elementary. Great work. So, next one. Function types, they intermingle with this other Haskell concept called type variable. And type variables, we haven't discussed about how they work, but most functions in Haskell Prelude are actually using type variables. Type variables, if you want some closed concept in Java, they are, you know, generics, the template variable in generics or in C++ in, I don't know what other generic facilities are there in other languages. So basically the question is, if I have this very simple function, very elementary function, usually simpler the function is, more likely is it to have a type variable in its argument. That's one of the nice features of this type system. It's actually very useful. So which of these are correct? Remember that you read this operator as f, f could have this type. F could be a function from int to int to int. If you write this definition and this definition in a source code file, will things compile? Will it accept that f x y is function from 2 ints into an int? Will it accept that it's a function from any a to any a to any a? And so on. Which of these are possible? Which of these would work? Multiple ones, of course, work. You can always choose more narrow type than is possible. So you can instantiate type variables and over-constrain your functions if you like. And then 1 minute according to this clock here. As a hint, there are multiple correct answers. Now I forgot what the time was before I asked the question. Oh, that's a bell. Yeah, I guess we have had enough time. So click in your opinions if you haven't done so. Yeah, heard a very distinctive click, so I guess people have clicked in. So. Yeah, great, actually. Last year I remember this exact same question, and we had a long discussion of why this is so. But in this case, I think it's, you know, pretty clear. Almost everyone agrees on the correct result, so we can skip the group discussion here. I can just explain the answer. And after I've done the explaining, please ask if it's still vague for you. So, first one, if x and y would be ints, would this work? Well, x is an int, y is an int, and the return value is an int. So, function of two parameters, int, int, and int. Yeah, it would work. There's nothing there stopping x and y from being ints. They could be ints. We could write like this. Also, can we write like this? That, you know, I don't care actually what x and y are. They are of type A for whatever A you care to select. And the function works by taking one A called x, another A called y, and it returns the first one of these. Yes, obviously, these work. Fine. I mean, there's nothing actually constraining this expression at all. So you could use this expression by, you know, ints, like here, doubles, strings, booleans, emails, whatever type you would care to write in place of A, it would work. Then again, This is again over-constraining the function. So we can get more general type. This type says that x is of type A. I don't care what the A is, it's just some A. And y is of type B. And please choose any type you want as a B. And it will return you value of type A. Yes, this again works. Since y, which now has the type B, doesn't appear in the result value at all. So it can be really independent from anything else. And this is the most generic type that you can write for this function. And if you write this type, you can of course use this same function as if it had this type or this type. So every time someone gives you a function that has type variables, you can just, you know, choose the type variable, say, in your program you want A to be double and B to be string, and you get a double out. So you can choose freely, there's nothing to stop you from choosing any type. However, this thing doesn't work. So we have x being a b and y being an a, and I can't, you know, say that the return value is a, because I'm returning x and it is b. Well, there's small dissonance here, because this thing works. Of course, these B and A, they can be the same, but not necessarily. There's nothing demanding that they are the same. And here we are explicitly saying that they can be different. So it doesn't work. X is of type B and we are returning X, so the return type should be B. It can't be an A. The Y that has the type A doesn't appear in the function body at all. And finally, if these are all different, this doesn't work at all. X and Y have types A and B, but you are returning X, and this declares X to be of type C. And obviously X can't be of type C since we have just claimed this of type A. So of course you can, you know, have this kind of a behavior by using a type declaration like this. Okay, is everything clear enough? This is usually one of the pain points in the course, these function types. They are hard. And yeah, that would be the group work. And oh, there's one, you know, I promised you one spelling error for each set of slides, and there you have it. I'm missing some spaces. So for the next time, we are going to discuss about data types. So you have to figure out what is the difference between type, new type, and data. Decide how these differ from each other. Figure out what is a sum type, what is a product type, and what is a function type. Hint, function type, we just learned what that is. And figure out what's an algebraic data type. What kind of a definitions can you make? What the bleep is a constructor function? Never seen one of those. It's definitely not the same as Java constructors or object-oriented constructors. Figure out how do you do pattern matching and how this case of statement works. Bit like an if, but much more powerful. And then, as a bonus, figure out what's the difference between type and a type constructor. That's what I want you to learn for the next lecture. And any questions, I will be taking the questions now here, if anyone has anything.